Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry into the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
Save big on everything for your next project when you shop at Menards. Check out our huge in-stock selection of TruBolt door locks. We have a variety of styles and finishes to suit your needs. TruBolt door locks provide homeowners and builders with quality door locks at an affordable price. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening now.
Save big money at
This season of Desert Island Dishes is sponsored by Maldon Salt, the finest natural sea salt flakes handcrafted from the British coastline. They are, quite frankly, the masters of salt, putting craft, care, and passion into everything they do. You only have to read one of my recipes to know that I use Maldon Salt every single day for all of my cooking. To say I am a fan is an understatement, so to be working with them this season is a dream come true. I'm often asked about the secret to getting better at cooking, and my answer is honestly always the same. It comes down to seasoning, and not just as an afterthought. You have to season at every stage, and that's why I love Maldon Salt. It's light and delicate due to the soft and crunchy pyramid-shaped flakes, and it's just the easiest way to take simple dishes to the next level. Trust me, your cooking life will not be the same. Thank you very much to Maldon Salt. Hi, I'm Margie Nomura, and welcome to the Desert Island Dishes podcast. This is the podcast where every week I ask my guests to choose their seven Desert Island dishes. These range from finding out about the dish that most reminds them of their childhood, the best dish they've ever eaten, and of course, the last dish they would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island. The question is, what would you choose as your last meal? Hi, how are you all? I hope everyone is having a great week. We are racing through this season of Desert Island Dishes, and this week we have a man who doesn't do many interviews, the one and only Marco Pierre White. We traveled to Bath to his hotel, the Rudlow Arms, and as we were setting up, I think he was a bit worried we were moving in permanently, but I think I won him over in the end. Marco runs the Rudlow Arms with his daughter, and it obviously means a lot to him. Family is at the centre of everything he does, and he now splits his time between the beautiful countryside outside of Bath, and he's also very passionate about the work he does with P&O Cruises. So he creates menus for them, he hosts masterclasses, and so for a large part of the year, he's travelling the world with P&O Cruises. So I was very lucky to catch him after one of his trips. I should say a huge thank you to Michelle for arranging the interview with Marco. And now, without further ado, here is today's episode. My guest today is Marco Pierre White, the original rock and roll chef. Marco was a chef who cooked like an angel, looked like a rock star, and changed the way the world thought of British food. Born in Leeds to a chef father and Italian mother, he was the third of four sons. As a teenager, he travelled to London with just £7.36 in his pocket to pursue a career in cooking. He trained under some of the most famous chefs in the world, Pierre Coffman, Albert Roux and Nico Ladonné. He opened Harvey's in 1987, aged just 25, and at the age of 32, he became the first British chef to win three Michelin stars and the youngest chef in the world to achieve such a thing. He would also be the first chef to hand back his Michelin stars, and he now runs the Rudlow Arms in Bath, where we are today, working with his daughter. He says family is the driving force behind everything he does. Marco, it's such an honour to have you on Desert Island Dishes. Thank you so much for being here.
Well, I feel very honoured that you've invited me on.
When researching you, people throw around phrases like, greatest chef the world has ever seen, he changed the face of British cooking. Does that mean anything to you?
Not really. No. Because I always say, well, firstly, I think what's important is that people realise that I never won the three stars. It was the team behind me, the young women and the young men. They won the stars. They were the orchestra. they created the symphony. I was just the composer and the conductor. And I think that's what's important in life. To think that you won 3 stars, I think is wrong, because without Robert Reed, Roger Pisey, Lee Bunting, and the list goes on, we would never have won 3 stars. And the truth is, it was those individuals who realised my dream. But in return, what I did do was I showed them what was possible and I gave them their dream.
Mm, that's an amazing way to think about it. Did you always feel that way, or has that come with a lot of self-reflection? Were you always aware that it was a group effort?
Well, I always look back when I was asked to give a quote for the Sunday Times. And the quote I gave, I didn't really think much about it at the time. I just said it. And I said, success is born out of arrogance, but greatness comes from humility. And the next day, I bumped into the great Sir Clement Freud. Some people loved him, some people were disapproving of him. I liked him. And he said to me, he said, Marco, you speak like that, Marco, was that your quote or did you read it? And I said, it was my quote in the Times yesterday. He said, a very, very, very good quote. And so then I started to think about what I'd said. And I thought, it's true. If you think of people like Cassius Clay or Muhammad Ali, who were very arrogant when they were young, but then went on to become great. And if I think of all the people in my life who were great, because I worked with a lot of great cooks, but not all of them became great people. Some of them couldn't let go of the baton. They want to keep hold of it. And, you know, it's like people ask me, why did you give your 3 stars back, Marco? And I said, because I never wanted to live a lie. I never wanted to pretend to cook when I didn't cook. Because what you've got to realise, I came from the very old world of gastronomy. I came from Escoffier's world, where chefs were behind the stove. Chefs never looked at their watches. Chefs worked 7 days a week if they had to. Chefs never called in sick. Chefs never walked out. It was a very different world. But our place was in the kitchen behind the stove. And I didn't want to live a lie. And that's why I do say a chef is allowed to stray from the stove.
You do say that now.
But he should always stay close to the flame. And it's like people ask me, why did you retire from the stove? And the truth is, I no longer enjoyed it. Winning 3 stars is a very exciting journey. It really is. It's a very painful one, physically and emotionally. But when you win 3 stars, it all becomes rather boring because it's just repetition. It's conveyor belt cuisine. You're turning out your specialities because that's why people are coming. I think you have to question yourself, what motivates you? I think that's the most important.
What would your answer be?
Well, I was never motivated by money.
Ever?
Never in my life.
You weren't interested in the fame either.
Nor was I. Well, the world I came from, no one was famous. Mm. I suppose the most famous TV chef was Robert Carrier. Mm. It's like now I'm not interested in fame. What I've learned in my life is that privacy is freedom. That's what I've learned.
So if you weren't driven by fame and you weren't driven by money, what was your driving force?
Romance. Everything I do in my life has to be romantic. Whether it was food, whether it's building a hotel, it has to be romantic, otherwise I'm not interested. I like Mother Nature. That's what inspires me. And that's what assisted me in winning 3 stars. As I've always said, great cooks have 3 things in common. Firstly, they accept and respect that Mother Nature is the true artist. And then they are the cook. They accept that. two, everything that they do becomes an extension of them as a person. And thirdly, and most importantly, they give you great insight into the world they were born into, the world which inspired them, and they serve it on their plates. That's what great cooks do. My favourite restaurant in the entire world has no Michelin stars. The menu hasn't changed since 1955. That's cool.
Where is that?
That's rather beautiful. La Colombe d'Or in Saint-Paul-de-Vence, about 20 minutes outside of Nice. It's so beautifully romantic, and the food is so simply delicious. Like, you'll get your beautiful white asparagus with a sauce hollandaise. You know, you'll have your artichokes barigoule. You'll have crudité done beautifully. You'll have your hors d'oeuvres. But where the table is filled with all these little old-fashioned hors d'oeuvre dishes with all these delicious hors d'oeuvres inside. Because gastronomy is about indulgence. I like to eat.
Let's dive straight into the first desert island dish. And that's a dish that most reminds you of your childhood.
When I think back to my childhood, I'm very close to my mother.
Mm.
And I spent a lot of time with my mother, because I don't even know that my mother died when I was six. And so, as my uncle Gianfranco said, your mother gave the last 6 years of her life to you, Marco. And that is true, really, because my brothers were 6 and 7 years older, and they had run off into the woods and the fields, whatever. And so I would spend time with my mother, watching her make things like risotto, pasta, watching her mince the meat for her bolognese or her meatballs. But even down to something as simple as watching my mother, my nonna, my auntie Paolo, my auntie Luciana, watch them all around the table in a place called Gattona, where we used to spend our summers preparing the minestrone, or even picking peaches off a tree when they're still warm and eating them, watching them collect the figs and bleed their milk. So I'd say it was that moment of all those, like when I see a risotto, or I see a minestrone, or I see a broth, or I see a pasta dish, it always takes me back in time. And I like to go back in time. I suppose as you get older, you become more nostalgic. So things that had little value when you were a child now have enormous value.
Yeah.
And that's the beauty of growing old.
There's a pasta dish that I think you've described as being your mother's pasta, with tomato paste and pancetta and onion.
It was bacon. The posh people would use pancetta. But it was streaky bacon. I cooked it for Jonathan Meads one night, and he wrote about it. It was New Year's Day in 1989, I think. And there was Roly Lee, there was Simon Hopkins, and there was great Nicolette. And we'd all had lunch with the great Anthony Blonde, who was a publisher. And we went to Jonathan's house and his wife, Frances. And it was New Year's Day, and they had nothing in their fridge, really. But everybody was hungry. And nobody had the courage to cook.
Really?
It was quite interesting.
Quite an intimidating group, I guess.
But I suppose I cooked more than all of them, because I cooked every day of my life. So I decided to cook. So I looked at what was in the fridge, and there was some tomato puree, there was some parmesan, there was some spaghetti, there was onions, and there was garlic. So I cooked for them in 89. But this must have been about 95. I cooked for Jonathan. He came to review me at the restaurant in the Hyde Park Hotel. He said, I knew Marco Pierre White was a genius when he was at my house on New Year's Day several years ago, and he cooked for myself and some chefs the simplest dish out of nothing. And when I next saw Jonathan, I said, Jonathan, what was interesting was it was the first time I ever cooked that dish.
Really?
Because I'd seen my mother cook it, and I'm looking at what I'm confronted with, which was zero, and I think, what can I cook? But that was one of my favourite dishes as a child.
But Marco, can I just say, like, the confidence to cook something like that, which is so simple for that particular group, like, that must have been what kind of blew him away.
I think it was more the eating of it, the deliciousness of it, because it was delicious.
But creating something so simple.
But out of nothing. That's what he was fascinated by. That's what he thought was the genius. But I think that dish is quite common in Italy anyway. But I think my favourite dish my mother used to make for us was in the afternoon when my brother and I were hungry. My mother would always take some Bourneville chocolate and chop it up and butter the sliced white bread and put the chocolate in it.
So
we'd have that. It's delicious.
Yeah, it's so good.
It's, but that's very Italian.
Mm.
I didn't realise that as a child. I'd never tell anybody because I used to think it was a strange thing to tell people. But it was delicious.
Yeah, so good.
But it's very Italian to give a child a chocolate sandwich in the afternoon. Mm. I suppose in France you have a pain au chocolat, don't you?
Obviously, for any child, losing a parent at such a young age is horrifying, and I'm so sorry that happened. You talk about the loss of your mother being the root of your drive to succeed. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think everybody has defining moments in their life. And I think, without question, that was the first ever defining moment in my life, is to watch your mother die and to watch her being carried away on a stretcher and put into an ambulance has to have an enormous impact on you. It has to damage you in the most extraordinary way. And so therefore, your fear of failure, your fear of not being accepted, your fear of not being good enough creates this extraordinary driving force within you. And then from the age of 6 to 16, being programmed by my father in that sort of very working class way, where you just push and you push and you push, and it doesn't matter how many times you get knocked down, you just pick yourself up and dust yourself down. You were never allowed to show emotions. So that extreme from a life being in full colour and being romantic and rather beautiful to then being in black and white and very hard, and then at the age of 13 being sent to work at 5 o'clock every morning until 8:45, then having to go into school and do the milk round 6 days a week to bring money home for the family. But having said that, the combination of my mother and my life with my mother, the death of my mother, and then that hardness of my father. And remember, my father got lung cancer when I was 10. It was a very damaging childhood. But the combination of all those tragedies and misfortunes, the softness and the hardness, drove me.
Did it feel tough at the time? Or is it no. only on reflection?
Because
that
that's all you know. Mm. You have nothing to compare it with.
Yeah.
And you don't talk about it. So remember, the truth is, you may think this is difficult to accept, but I'm an introvert. I hide from society. I hide from people. I've taught myself how to navigate and how to sit with someone like yourself and talk openly. But I like my privacy. I like being left alone.
We're going to pause there and talk about the second desert island dish. What's the first dish you learned to cook?
When I was a boy, I had to help in the kitchen. So, and I'd be taught how to peel potatoes with my little hands and a knife, or do the sprouts or do the swede. So I always had to work at home. And so I suppose those were the dishes that I first learned how to make, was cabbage. And the secret of buttered cabbage is white pepper. White pepper's good, but it's very working class. I suppose buttered cabbage, rice pudding, things that we made at home.
Mm.
And watching them make gravy. I like gravy. Very few people make good gravy.
What's your secret
to making gravy?
Why do so many people make a bad gravy?
Because they don't invest the time. Nor, so for example, at Christmas, I always make the turkey gravy. And I love turkey gravy. I always cook my turkey on the crown. So the rest of the bird, so you take the gizzards, the heart, and the liver, park that. Then the rest of the bones are all chopped up and roasted. Then lots of onions and garlic, bay leaf and thyme, which have been sweated off. Put the two together. See, I have the privilege of veal stock. So I'll mostly use 1/3 veal stock. And I'll use 1/3 chicken stock and maybe 1/3 water. But mineral water, not tap water. I don't like the chlorine in it. Then I will cook my gravy. But I've retained the fat from the roasting of the bones, the gravy fat, the rendered skin, the turkey. And then I prepare my gizzards, my livers and my heart, and then I dice them all. And then I pass off my gravy, but I always season it with a bit of gnaw rather than salt. And I always add a tiny bit of Bisto.
Oh, do you?
Because their flavours, most people are used to Bisto.
Yeah.
But you would never know Bisto was in it. You'd never know gnaw was in it.
Yeah.
But if they weren't in it, you'd miss it. Because I was taught as a boy by Mr. Reed at the Box Tree, which was a restaurant which had 2 stars in Michelin in the late 70s. He said, Marco, it doesn't matter how you create the desired effect, as long as you create the desired effect. And that's true. You have to strip off the blinkers in life and look at something for what it is, not for what you want it to be.
That's very true. We're going to pause there and talk about the third desert island dish. What's the best dish you've ever eaten?
Eating is always about the emotional impact. It's about the ritual. It's about the indulgence. If I think of dishes that I had with Coffinet La Tante Claire, if I think of dishes I had with Albert at the Le Gavroche, the Waterside, with Michel Roux, with Raymond Blanc, with the great Nicolas Denis, with the great Guy Mouiron, Jean-Louis Tabayot, the list goes on. And when you think, some of them are so simple, like there was a restaurant called Ma Cuisine. The chef was called Guy Mouiron. He was the first ever head chef of Gavroche. He would just cook you an escalope of wild salmon à la ose, like they did in Trois Gros, cooked minqui, just beautifully done. Or like at the Gavroche, the bouillon vessi, the chicken cooked in a pig's bladder, Kaufman's, you know, the pied de cochon vassi with the riz de veau and the mori. And it's all about being seduced. It's all about the emotional impact. The only way to describe it is like falling in love with somebody and going to bed with them for the very first time. You're intimidated by their beauty.
Do you remember the first dish that really made you feel like that? Do you remember the first dish that you ate that just completely blew your mind?
But let's go back to the Hotel St. George. I thought chicken Kiev was genius.
Well,
and the truth was, when it was first created, it was genius. Because if you think of the concept of it. So at 16, it was very easy to impress me. And the people who tend to impress me are people who don't try to impress me. There's nothing worse than someone trying to impress you. My favourite restaurant in London is Riva. It's understated. It's very humble. The food is deliciously simple. With a nice glass of wine, what more do you want?
We're on to the most important question of the day, the fourth desert island dish. Marco Pierre White, what is your favourite sandwich?
Ah, now that's an art.
Yes.
In making a good sandwich.
Talk to me.
Ratios are very important. Forget the ingredients to begin with. You can have the best ingredients in the world. But if the ratios are wrong, then it's not a great sandwich. But I'll tell you, and I said this the other week, I was asked a question which actually made me think of a sandwich.
Mm.
And I was on Britannia. And the F&B man, Alessio, said, Marco, as Alessio. He said, we've just got Market Cafe open and they're making these amazing sandwiches, Marco. Do you want one for lunch? So I said, what flavours do they have? He says, Marco, they've got salumi and mortadella with mozzarella and sun-dried tomatoes. They've got prawn cocktail. They've got chicken coronation. And they've got one with cheese. I wasn't interested. I said, Alessio, are you going to have one with me? He said, of course, Marco. I said, why don't we have the mortadella with the salumi, the tomato and the mozzarella with the rocket? We'll have a prawn cocktail one and we'll have a chicken coronation one.
That is the correct answer.
I have to be brutally honest. I was shocked. I was really shocked, one, by the construction, two, by the presentation, and three, by the filling and the flavouring. Mm. I think that could possibly be the best thing I've ever eaten on a ship, apart from Sindhu's curries or the smoked salmon by Foreman's. Actually, there's a long list of other things I prefer, but that's another story. But no, on P&O, Britannia, they made these sandwiches, 2/3 filling, 1/3 bread, but wrapped and packed beautifully, and then they slice it when they're wrapped and packed, and then they open it out. it's amazing. So it's like looking at a millefeuille. It's so amazing.
What kind of bread was it?
Depends on the sandwich that you had. But it was very good. But I was more fascinated by the fillings and the construction and the way they'd wrapped it. He was like an origami expert. It looks like the most perfect gâteau from a patisserie in France, in Paris. Beautifully made and very well seasoned. It was that good. And then I had to do a speech in front of 1,000 people. And one of the questions, because you do your Q&A, and then one of the questions comes back and said, what's your favourite sandwich? And I said, I've just had the most delicious sandwich. So it was irony that actually 2 days later, 2 days later, they asked me when I was on the ship, what's my favourite sandwich? And so then I told them about the Market Cafe because it just opened. Oh, they were bombarded. They couldn't cope. They had to pull the plug on it. They'd say we've run out of sandwiches.
Abort. But I did read that one of your favourites is a very simple ham and English mustard.
I like ham and mustard. I like corned beef and Branston. But the other day I went to this farm shop. Now that was good. There's a farm shop down the road in Bruton and it's very nice, or Burton. And I just have a normal bacon sandwiches. But the time before I'd had lunch and they gave me these very nice sun-dried tomatoes with my salumi. I said, could I have a bacon sandwich, please? But could I have it with some of your nice sun-dried tomatoes? And I am not joking. A bacon sandwich with sun-dried tomatoes where they've had the chill removed from them. Don't leave them in the fridge. With HP, the combination of HP sauce, sun-dried tomatoes, and deliciously salty bacon.
That sounds really good.
And only toast your bread on the outside, not on the inside.
So you still get some fluffiness.
Yes.
Yeah, best of both worlds. Part of the legend of your story was that you achieved 3 Michelin stars cooking this amazing French classical food whilst having never... Well, one of the reports I read said that you'd never been to France.
Even to this day, I've never dined in a Michelin-starred restaurant in France.
On purpose.
I've never done anyone full stop.
Have you not?
No. I've never, ever, ever dined in a Michelin-starred restaurant in France.
Do you think you ever will?
I don't know. I'm a curious creature. I saw some very beautiful pictures of Maxime's the other day, Maxime's de Paris, which was one of the very first restaurants I fell in love with, which had 3 stars in Michelin, 5 black knives and forks. La Serre, according to Mr. Reed, was the ultimate, which had 3 stars in Michelin and 5 red knives and forks. And so when I was 17 years old, that became my dream, was to replicate the great La Serre with 3 stars and 5 red knives and forks. The only restaurant in Britain to have 5 red knives and forks was the Ritz, but they had no stars. And so therefore, I worked at realising my dream. I think when you have a dream, you have to make it come true. As I say to my daughter, Mirabel, do you have a dream? And she says, yes, Daddy. I never ask her dream. I always say to her, if you have a dream, then you have a duty and a responsibility to yourself to make it come true.
But yours really did start at the age of 16. That was when you decided that's what you wanted.
No, 17 when I went to Box Tree. And so when I opened Harvey's, in those days, the guide used to come out in January. And so we opened in January 87. In the 88 guide, we got 1 star with 2 knives and forks.
We're going to pause there and talk about the 5th desert island dish. Marco, what's the dish you eat the most often?
Well, I don't know if I've come across as this individual who's quite obsessive. So if I like something, I can eat it for a week. But then my obsession will change and I'll eat that for a week. Anything I find delicious, I can eat for a week. It's like if I like a person, I can sit with them for a week. In the end, I'll get bored of them. Like I'll get bored of the sandwich or the plate of food, whatever.
I think it's called a hyperfixation.
Is that what it's called? Say that again.
A hyperfixation.
Hyperfixation. I think I've suffered from that all my life, actually. But in a positive way rather than a negative.
Yeah.
What is the dish that I eat the most often? The last 3 days I've had a bacon sandwich for breakfast with HP.
Can't go wrong with that.
I like that. But again, it's ratios and construction.
What do you normally cook for supper on a weeknight if you're cooking for yourself?
I don't cook for myself.
You don't?
No.
Who cooks?
I have staff.
Where do you eat?
I go out, I have staff.
Okay. So you don't really cook for pleasure?
No, no.
When did that stop?
I've never really cooked for pleasure.
Really?
I don't think so. It's always been a job. The pleasure is not the cooking. It's the making. Because, I mean, when you think, if you cook, it's... They're long days. They're not pleasurable.
No, not that kind of cooking.
There's something rather nice when everything's been done. I think the pleasure is in the eating, not the cooking.
But then do you feel sad that you are the one that gets to eat your food the least?
I don't think of it like that, but I suppose going back, I like plucking grouse. I like... There's something rather beautiful about plucking something or preparing something. Like, I like taking a whole sea bass and working on a whole sea bass. There's something rather beautiful about it. I like simplicity. It's like the other day, I cooked some sea bass en croûte de sel, which is a rather beautiful way of cooking. Is a sea bass en croûte de sel. Have you ever cooked en croûte de sel? It's beautiful. But then I like something as simple as a grilled over sole on the bone, and then remove the skirt when it's cooked. So all you've got is a cap going down the middle. But then I love a kipper. My favourite way of cooking kippers.
Mm.
I love a kipper. Do you know what my favourite way of cooking a kipper is? Most people put them under the grill, which intensifies the salt. Then you've got that pathetic way they do, where they call it jugged kippers, where they drop them in a jug of boiling water.
Yeah.
Forget it, because all that does is wash off flavour.
Mm. What do you do?
On a plate, paint it with butter, wrapping cling film, in the microwave, 2 to 2.5 minutes. They're best.
Really?
The best way of cooking kippers.
Oh my goodness, I need to try that.
You should. Let me know how you get on
with it.
I will.
I'm going to go
home and try
that.
Do you like kippers?
I do.
But get a good kipper, a proper big kipper.
Yeah.
With the head on and everything.
Yeah. Don't mess around.
Not the fillets.
No.
No, really good.
Okay, that's a top tip. I think I'd be scared to share that with you if it was the other way around. I'd be scared to tell you that the best way I'd found was in the microwave.
Microwaves are sensational things.
Mm.
If you're cooking the whole... When we used to cook the whole veal kidneys in the fat, we'd start them in the microwave.
Oh, would you?
Because it cooked from the inside out.
I feel like people are quite snobby about the microwave.
Well, that's why I said take off the blinkers. If you want to cook marrow bone, the best way of cooking marrow bone is in the microwave. The best.
Really?
If you want to warm up a fish terrine... In the microwave, it's the best.
Okay. I have to ask you about giving the Michelin stars back. In that moment, like, how did you feel? Or how do you feel on reflection?
Well, firstly, we touched on it earlier. I didn't want to live a lie where I pretend I cook when I don't cook and I continue to charge high prices.
Yeah.
So let me give you an example. Do you like Elton John?
I do.
So we go to the Albert Hall tonight, yes. I bought you tickets. The lights go down, the curtain opens, and there's a spotlight on Elton's piano. And on the stage walks his number two to play his piano and sing his songs. Would you want your money back? So tell me, what's the difference then? If you're going to a three-star or a two-star Michelin, and the chef is not in the kitchen, he's somewhere else in the world. Why are you paying those prices? So they're living lies, aren't they? I couldn't be one of those chefs. I wish I had the courage to live a lie, continue to charge those prices, and retain my status as a three-star chef. But I didn't come from that world. And this thought comes into my head. Marco, you're being judged by people who have less knowledge than you. So be honest with yourself, Marco, like you've always been honest to yourself. This is me talking to myself within my head. This is my subconscious and my conscious talking to each other. So what's it worth? If you are given stars by people who have less knowledge, what's it worth? Like when they took away a star from Ramsay at Claridge's. What they were saying is that every restaurant in this world with one star serves better food than Gordon did at Claridge's. Not true. I know Gordon. I've known him since he was a young man. Not true, is it?
No.
And some of the restaurants I've been to, they're not two stars. They're not one star. It's a joke.
Marco, we're on to the sixth Desert Island
dish.
Wow.
Tell me.
What is your go-to dinner party dish?
I don't do dinner parties.
Oh, I was going to ask.
I don't do dinner
parties.
Have
you ever?
I don't like dinner parties.
Because you don't like people?
I like people, but I don't like herds of people.
Okay. What would be the maximum number you could have?
I like having dinner with two or three, including myself.
Yeah.
I prefer to have two or three six times a week than one big dinner party.
Okay.
But I think if you're going to do a dinner party, you've got to be clever. Because it tends to be one person in the kitchen cooking a dinner party for 8 or 10 people.
Yeah.
So, again, allow strategy to deliver. So, for example, do a great beef Wellington.
Yeah.
Do a great daube de bœuf with whole cheeks of a box. Yes, bang. Do a great risotto. Yeah, keep it simple. Put it in the middle of the table and let people help themselves.
The best. What would you serve for pudding?
Well, again, I would go down that road again. You'd make something delicious, like a delicious bread and butter pudding.
Oh, yeah.
Which is super light, which has only got one layer of bread with lots of custard.
So good.
Or even a rice pudding. I like things which are simple.
Are you a pudding person?
Not really. I prefer cheese.
Okay.
I like a cheese.
What about the story of when you threw the cheese board at the wall?
Well, I wasn't eating it. Okay. That's because it wasn't acceptable. Because they've been too lazy to do it properly. Because after lunchtime services, they've got fresh cheeses, and those cheeses should have gone to the staff.
So that was before it had gone out like that?
They were taking it out for the evening service.
Ah, okay.
At lunchtime, what they hadn't done is, at lunchtime, when you finish your lunch, say you've got a cheese so large,
yeah,
and there's half of it, get rid of it. Put another two of them.
Yeah.
So put another two, say they're ripe for dinner.
Mm.
Say you've got a vacherin, and two-thirds of it has been used. Then put a fresh one out for dinner. That goes to staff. But that's what they didn't do. They're too lazy to redo. And that's why they had to look at the wall.
On Desert Island Dishes, we have a cookbook corner. So I'd love to know, what is your most treasured cookbook?
I think the greatest cookbook of all time was written by Quentin Crewe, called The Great Chefs of France. All those chefs, the last one just died, Michel Gérard. But it was Gérard. It was the Toigrou brothers. It was Pic. It was Bis. Barrier. Bocuse. Outier. Raymond Twillier. And it gave you great insight into that three-star world, like no other book. And the photographs were taken by Blake. I must have read that book 50, 60 times.
Oh, really?
But inspected every single photograph with such intensity. And that's the book that gave me the insight to understand what a three-star world was.
Marco, we're on to the seventh, final desert island dish. What is the last dish you would choose to eat before being cast off to the desert island?
I think it would be a bottle of Mouton Rothschild's 1961.
Okay. I love that. That's it.
The year I was born.
Yeah.
I think it's a little late to start worrying about what I'm going to have for dinner, don't you?
Okay, that's perfect.
Or a bottle of 1929, Mouton Rothschild's, Petrus, whatever, I don't know.
Okay.
Something delicious.
You can have both.
I think I'd just have a drink. I think that'd be nice and just pontificate and think about, reflect on my life.
We've never had that as an answer before, but that's very fitting for you, Marco.
Originality is only original if you're the first.
Exactly. So, Marco Pierre-White, those were your Desert Island Dishes. So there we have it. Another delicious day of Desert Island Dishes. Don't forget you can find me on Instagram at Desert Island Dishes, where you'll find snippets from the interviews, lots of recipes, and much, much more. You can visit the website desertislanddishes.co or sign up for my weekly newsletter, Dinner Tonight, where I share one easy and delicious weeknight recipe every week. You can find that at dinnertonight.substack.com. Thank you again to Mould and Salt for helping us to bring the podcast to you every week. And thank you so much for listening. Bye.
Buy now and make no payments until fall. That's right. At Jeff Weiler's Columbus Auto Mall, drive today with no down payment and no payments for 120 days. Whether it's a car, truck, or SUV, why wait? Shop hundreds of vehicles, all with no payments till fall. Hurry in to the Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall, where the deals won't wait, and neither should you. Find us on Gender Road or JeffWeilerColumbusAutoMall.com.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/kidsandfamily. Just go to Indeed.com/kidsandfamily right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need. You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed's sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.